Everyone knows that Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay were the first people to set foot atop the summit of Mount Everest in 1953. But there's a possibility, however remote, that two other men reached the summit almost 30 years before that. On a 1924 expedition to the mountain, climbers George Mallory and Andrew Sandy Irvin were last seen alive a few hundred metres from the top, sparking a debate that goes on to this day as to whether one or both reached the summit before they died. To talk about this, I'm joined by historian and author Mark McMenamin. Last year, Mark produced for radio with Donal O'Herlihy, The Lost Mountaineers, a documentary on one feature, which delves into the Mallory expedition and asks the question, did Mallory and Irvin reach the summit nearly three decades before Hillary and Tenzing 100 years ago this year? Now, we get to that. We might have an argument about that one. But let's first go back to how the mountain began to capture the world's imagination as soon as Everest was discovered to be the tallest mountain in the world. People immediately wanted to climb it. It would have been around the 1850s.
Yeah, I suppose it first comes to attention in the 1850s with the Great Survey of India and the Topographical Survey, where they determine that Everest is indeed the tallest mountain in the world. And it's measured to 29,000 feet. I think they were out by about 30 feet on it, you know, which was incredibly accurate for the time. Of course, straight away, you know, there's, I suppose, a huge desire to try and climb it. And, you know, especially kind of the dying days of the British Empire, they want to be the first to get there. And this all kind of, you know, starts to come to fruition in the golden age of adventure and the golden age of alpinism. Now, of course, like, they weren't able to get into Nepal. Nepal was a closed country. So any expeditions would have had to be on the Tibetan side. And there was some difficulty in getting in there as well. Eventually, there's a deal made kind of, I think, where there's an exchange with arms and et cetera. And they're granted passage into Tibet. The Alpine Club, which is the main climbing club in London, comes together with the Royal Geographical Society, you know, located in Kensington Gore there near to the Royal Albert Hall, which we're all familiar with. They formed the Mount Everest Committee and they tried to put together a team to, first of all, map the mountain and to see if there's a viable route up it. It's led by Charles Howard Bury, who has his own connections to Ireland through...
Mullingar,
yeah.
Belvedere House.
Yeah. Belvedere House. He leads the expedition, an incredibly precise guy, you know, a really good person to go and organise that that reconnaissance expedition in 21. And amongst the number there, one of the climbers is George Lee Mallory. And they go there in 1921 and it's a complete success. I mean, as an expedition, it's a complete success. They produce the first maps of the mountain and a viable route is actually found up the mountain via what is called the North Col. And they can launch an assault then up the northeast ridge. They don't attempt to climb it, but plans are made for 1922 when they're going to come back and put the first assault team together to try and reach the summit.
Okay, tell us about Mallory, because he's probably the most famous climber who was there in 1921. He goes back in 1922. So give us an idea of his background.
George Mallory was a very interesting character. He was born in Moberly near Cheshire. He was the son of a vicar. And, you know, from an early age, he had a huge interest in climbing. You know, there's stories of him trying to climb the steeple in the Father's Church, for example, you know, from a very early age. He's educated at public school and then he goes off to the First World War where he's an artillery officer. I suppose he's hugely affected by, you know, the trauma of the First World War. And when he returns, then he starts developing an interest in climbing again. He takes work as a kind of a teacher in a public school. Charterhouse School, and he even actually visits Ireland, you know.
He does, and that, I have to say, because when he visited Ireland, the War of Independence was going on, the first thing that occurred to me was this man a spy? What was he doing in Ireland in 1920? Former member of the British Army.
Yeah, the interesting thing with Mallory, if you look at his personality and the kind of guy he was kind of a socialist in his thinking. He was, you know, he used to pal around with people in the Bloomsbury set, and actually, we mentioned Charles Howard Bury. The two of them didn't get on, you know, on the 21 expedition.
Bury was very much the Anglo-Irish landlord.
Yeah, yeah. And Mallory is quoted as saying he was typical of the landlord class, you know. And also Mallory was kind of a notorious kind of a technophobe and very kind of a scattered kind of a guy, whereas, you know, Bury was a real precise military man. He comes to Ireland, actually. He gets a job working for the League of Nations, and he actually visits Dublin at the height of the War of Independence because he kind of wants to see it for himself. And he has, you know, a lot of sympathy for the nationalist cause. He actually writes, and, you know, this was a piece that was quoted in the Alpine Journal. This is Malory himself saying, "There has been wrong on both sides, but national aspirations, a passionate idealism, are to be found only on one side." This is Ireland. "It is to the fact that Irishmen appeal when they exclaim, 'If only people in England knew, if only they would come and see.'" So he came here to see for
himself.
And
he has a run-in with the Tans, doesn't he?
He had a run-in with the Black and Tans where he's kind of jostled. They come into his hotel room and they ask him, is he a Catholic or a Protestant? To which he allegedly retorts, "Don't you know that Sinn Féiners are both Catholic and Protestant?" You know? When they hear his English accent, they let him go. But he actually writes that when he walked around the streets of Dublin, he deliberately didn't put his hands in his pockets in case that he was attacked or shot. Mm. So, yeah.
So then he goes back in 1922, and this is not about mapping. This is presumably with the intention of climbing Everest, because it is there. And this is him. He's the man who actually originates that phrase. Why did you want to climb it? Because it's there.
Yeah, he said that when asked by a journalist from the New York Times, and it is the first attempt to get to the summit of Mount Everest. And it's quite a formidable team. And Malory, it's fair to say, is probably arguably one of the two best climbers in the world at that time. And the second best climber was also on the expedition, a gentleman by the name of George Ingall Finch, who was a chemist. And there are a number of summit attempts. They get very, very, very high up along the Northeast Ridge.
Are they using oxygen?
Now, Malory is against the use of oxygen because he considers it unsportsmanlike. The Sherpa people have a good nickname for it too. They call it English air, you know. So he's against it. It's unsportsmanlike. But Finch is an absolute advocate of using oxygen because he's a scientist, you know, and he knows the benefits of it. And interestingly enough, on the 21 expedition, a Scottish doctor was on that expedition by the name of Alexander Kellis, and he had the first writings really on the fact that you would need oxygen to really get up there because of, you know, above 6,000 metres, there's hypoxia, you know, you're in the death zone. So there's a number of attempts, and Finch actually sets a world altitude record, and Malory determined to try and outdo his rival. There's a third attempt, and unfortunately, on the third attempt, when Malory tries to beat Finch's world altitude record, which is over 8,500 meters on the mountain, it's incredibly high. There's an accident, and there's an avalanche, and some of the Sherpas are killed, and Malory is overcome with grief about this. He holds himself responsible for it, and he really decides that that's it for him. But the lure of the mountain is too much.
Now, they can't get back in 1923. They do get back in 1924. And something I discovered in the documentary, now I've always been fascinated by this subject, wasn't aware of the fact that there was an Irishman in the ill-fated Malory stroke Irvine expedition in 1924. Tell me about Richard Hingston.
Oh, Richard Hingston was the naturalist and medical officer on the 1924 expedition. Originally born in London, but he grew up in Passage West in County Cork and studied medicine in UCC. An incredibly interesting man, hugely interested actually in altitude as well. And he conducted experiments on some of the mountaineers to see the effects of altitude on the body. And he studied the flora and fauna of the area. And he was brought along. And he was someone actually that Malory really, really liked. Malory writes in his diaries, you know, that it's a really nice party. And one of the best is Hingston, you know, a quiet little Irish man, he calls him. But they got on really, really well. The leader of the expedition was the same leader as of the 1922 expedition. It was General Bruce. But he's struck down by malaria. And Hingston actually sends him home. And the second in command, Teddy Norton, Colonel Edward Norton, he takes over leadership of the expedition. So it's really plagued by misfortune from the beginning.
Yeah, and Andrew Irvine, and he's all about oxygen. That's one of the reasons why he's there.
Yeah, well, the oxygen officer on the expedition is Noel O'Dell, and his deputy is Sandy Irvine. And he brings Sandy Irvine along because he's a genius when it comes to mechanical, doing things with mechanics. As a young student in Merton College, Oxford, he actually designs a gear for the rotor on an airplane that you can fire a machine gun through the blades. Like, and that's actually sent to the Ministry of Defence, and they think this guy's a genius. They bring him along because O'Dell had him with them on the Merton College expedition to Spitsbergen, and they knew that he was physically fit, and he was a whiz with the oxygen set. Malory still isn't totally converted to oxygen at this stage, but with Irvine and O'Dell along, oxygen is being used on the expedition.
Now, as always, they have a very, very small window because the monsoon is coming, and obviously Mallory is determined that he is not going to be beaten by Everest on this occasion. So he and Irvin make the summit attempt. They're being watched by somebody you've already mentioned. He's not Irish. I always thought he was Irish, that his name was, he was O'Dell, Noel O'Dell. But listening to your documentary, the accent is far too plummy to be Irish. So describe to me what O'Dell sees and what he testifies to on the day on which Mallory and Irvin disappear.
Well, the most important thing to remember is Noel O'Dell is one of the best alpine climbers in the world at this particular time as well. He's a background in geology and he goes on to become a Cambridge professor of geology. So rocks are his thing, all right? And that's important. The route that Mallory and Irvin are said to have taken, and that's in dispute as well. O'Dell's the last person to see them. He takes their photograph as they leave the North Col. It's a famous photograph of the two of them strapping on the oxygen sets. Mallory has decided to use the oxygen because it's really his last chance.
Are they roped in that photograph?
They're not roped in that photograph, but the rope is important later on. They head off up the North Col and O'Dell climbs in support later. Now, he reaches a kind of a crag on the mountain and the summit is covered in mist. And he looks out over the summit ridge and there are three obstacles that are on this northeast ridge.
The first, second and third step.
And they're shrouded in mist. And all of a sudden there's a clearing. He describes it as a clearing in the atmosphere. And all of a sudden he sees two figures on what he believes to be the second step. And they're moving. And it's believed that if Mallory and Irvin were on top of the second step, then they were about 300 metres from the summit.
What time of the day is this?
12:50. It's a little bit late, okay, in the afternoon. They had intended to set off earlier, so the fact that he saw them at that time means they're going to be returning in darkness.
Now, you know as well as I do, 300 metres from the top, you were not talking about it's going to take you, you know, 30 seconds to make it. You're talking about hours at that stage.
3-4 hours climbing from that point, but it's totally feasible that they could have made there if they were indeed on the second step. Now, the second step, and I've spoken to one person in the documentary, Mountaineer Jason Black, who is one of very few people who has free climbed that. Most people today climb it with a ladder that was bolted in by the Chinese team in the 1960s, summiting team. It's no mean feat, but it is possible. And if he was seen there, then there's probably no doubt that they made it there. But when O'Dell comes back after the expedition, that sighting is called into question because they said there's no way that they could have made it up and down in within daylight hours. And, you know, was he acclimatized, etc. properly? Did he hallucinate? But, you know, I've spoken to Noel O'Dell's grandson and I've read Noel O'Dell's writings on this. I mean, he's written in the in the Alpine Journal that I have never been more certain of any observation, scientific or otherwise, that I saw Mallory and Irvin on the ridge that day.
Does he ever second guess himself?
He does. That's the thing. He second guesses himself later on in the 70s, the 80s, before events, saying it might have been the first step, which means there was no way they made it because they didn't have the time. That comes from a lot of pressure from the climbing community that people have speculated. But he goes back in the end then and he says, no, I'm certain I saw them there. If you look at his diary entries as well, you know, he's on two occasions he's claimed to have seen them there. And he's very determined towards the end of his life that he was correct in his first observation.
Now, the bodies of Mallory and Irvin are missing for decades. And then finally, Mallory's body is discovered. What is found?
Yeah, he's discovered in 1999, I suppose nearly almost by accident. There was an expedition to try and find the body, but they actually were looking for Sandy Irvin. In 1933, there'd been an expedition led by Frank Smythe where they find Irvin's ice axe and they trace a fall line straight down from it. And they think that they'll find Irvine there and hopefully find this elusive camera that he was meant to have been carrying that may contain a summit photo. They do indeed find a body and it turns out to be Mallory's. They find that out by looking actually at the collar of his jumper and the name G. Mallory is stitched into it. And their first reaction, the climbers, is, you know, why is Sandy Irvine wearing George Mallory's jumper? But it turns out to be George Mallory. They find his snow goggles are in his pocket. There's some circumstantial evidence, but no proof. His, you know, snow goggles are in his pocket, indicating that he was descending at night. His altimeter is broken. His wristwatch is broken. The most crucial piece of evidence of all,
the photograph.
The photograph of his wife Ruth, which he claimed that he would put on the summit, is missing. It's not there. He'd suffered really bad injuries. He'd hit an open wound fracture. His leg was, you know, it was completely broken. And he had severe rope jerk injuries around his waist. So he and Irvin were obviously roped together and the rope was broken. You know.
Now, I mean, being roped does suggest that they were trying to free climb the steps, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, it does strongly suggest that. So there's every possibility that they made it. I suppose unless Irvine's body is found and there's some proof, maybe a diary entry or something. Like the big difference in this and, say, the Scott expedition, the Terra Nova expedition, is that there was meticulous diaries kept, so we know there's nothing of the sort here, so it's left to speculation.
And Hillary is steeped in the lore of Mallory and Irvine, and he actually looks, when he does get to the top in 1953, he's looking for the photograph that was of Mallory's wife.
Yeah, and in his book High Adventure, he actually says that he looks down the, you know, the steep slopes of and down towards the North Col, and down along the northeast ridge, and he's kind of glad that he didn't come up that way himself. He looks for any sign, you know, that he can see that Mallory and Irvine had been there, like a stake in the ground, a piece of an oxygen set, the photograph, anything, and there's nothing there, you know. And one of the quotes that I love from Edmund Hillary is how he described when he eventually got to the summit of Mount Everest. He said, you know, the first thing that came through my mind was surprise. I was surprised. I thought of all the good people that had been here before me, so many good people, and here at the end of it all was old Ed Hillary, you know. So what I love about that is he's like the everyman character, you know, and that's what's so interesting about Edmund Hillary.
Mm. But if Mallory and Irvine had made it to the top, they would have been descending in darkness. And as you know, I mean, mountaineering is not just about getting there, it's about getting back in one piece as well, isn't it? That's the other half.
Yeah. So I think it's safe to say, I mean, like, you know, the first
person... I mean, it wouldn't impinge in any way on the achievement of Hillary and Tenzing had Mallory and Irvine got there because Hillary and Tenzing got back again.
No. And I think Edmund Hillary said that himself. He said, you know, he'd be slightly downgraded, I suppose, a little bit, he said, but not
slightly.
Much. Yeah. He said, like, you know, part of it's getting there and getting back. He certainly holds the achievement of the first person to summit it. But perhaps, you know, Mallory and Irvine made it to the top and obviously didn't get back down.
What's your own view?
I think it's entirely possible, yeah. There's no way of knowing. But mountaineering and adventure are full of people who do things against the odds. Look at Shackleton, look at people like that, you know. They do things totally against the odds. The odds were against George Mallory. But if you look at his writings, look at the kind of person he was. He once famously said that we are going to sail to the top this time and God with us are stamped to the top with the wind in our teeth. So that shows you the kind of guy he was. He was going to get there no matter what, I think.
Why did it take almost 30 years for the summit to be actually cracked then after that?
Well, obviously, like, there was expeditions in the 1930s with Eric Shipton, an amazing mountaineer himself. And then obviously there was nothing during the war, you know. So there was they decided then in the 1950s that, you know, they would try a different route through Nepal. The Tibetan side is, they're both very difficult, but I suppose it's slightly less difficult on the Nepalese side. Mm. And when I say slightly less.
Once you get over the crevasse at the bottom.
Yeah. And then and up the Lhotse face. And then it was the development of oxygen sets, you know, of reliable oxygen sets. And, you know, it just shows you the work of people like Alexander Kellis and Richard Hingston, our own Richard Hingston, that made the contribution to that and the science of knowing that oxygen was probably needed to get to the very top.
And Hingston buried in a very modest grave in Cork.
Yeah, buried in Passage West in County Cork. And, you know, sadly, someone who didn't really talk about what he did because he was in the Indian Medical Service in the British Army, probably never got the credit that he deserved and was never kind of lauded, probably in his own country in the way that he should have been, sadly.
Well, you have made up for that. You have atoned for that in the documentary, because if you want to hear more about this, and I would urge you to do so, you can listen to the documentary on one podcast from last year called The Lost Mountaineers, which goes into far more detail on this story and its Irish connection. So it's 100 years now, it's a century since the ill-fated Mallory and Irvine expedition, and that documentary presented by my guest Mark McManaman. Mark, many thanks indeed for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Miles.
After the break, we'll be looking at the life of another Everest explorer, Charles Howard Bury, and his relationship with his partner Rex Beaumont. Their extraordinary lives are revealed in photographs in the archives of Mullingar Library. Stay with us.